brothers and sisters. Namo Buddhaya. Jai Bhim. So today I've been partly in India, much of the day. My thoughts have been in India, and my text message machine has been in India a lot of the day. And in fact, I received a phone call, two phone calls from India this afternoon while I was trying to rest. After a long drive all the way from Wales. So people have been ringing me and text messaging me because today is a very, very important day for Indian Buddhists, the 30 or more million people who are Buddhists in India are celebrating today really the most important occasion in their history, the occasion when Dr. Ambedkar relaunched Buddhism in India. You all know that Buddhism flourished in India, well, grew in India. The Buddha himself was an Indian. But in the Middle Ages, under the impact of Muslim invasion, under the impact of resurgent Brahminical Hinduism, Buddhism died out. All trace of Buddhism almost completely disappeared. People in India did not even know that the Buddha was Indian. That it was not even known that much. Bodh Gaya, where he gained enlightenment, was forgotten. Most of the sites where the Buddha had lived were just mounds, which you know were associated with local deities and so on. And interestingly enough, it was a British general who rediscovered most of the holy sites of Buddhism in India. That's another story. Anyway, yes, on this day, 1956, 400,000 people converted to Buddhism in the central Indian city of Nagpur, under the influence of the very great figure, leader, Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. So for Indian Buddhists, this is an enormously important occasion. All day long, people would have been going to celebrations here and there. In Nagpur itself, probably a million people will have gathered at what's known as the Dikshabhumi, the place of conversion. And crowds and crowds and crowds of them will have gathered at the place where Dr. Ambedkar converted with his followers. They'll be singing songs about Dr. Ambedkar. They'll be listening to political speeches, I'm afraid. Politics gets in everywhere. Well, it has to. They'll have been chanting and so on and so forth all day long in Nagpur. A massive, massive occasion there. Everywhere else, in Maharashtra particularly, the state around Bombay, there will be people who will have been coming together to celebrate this very, very auspicious, very, very important occasion. In fact, in India, it's known as Dhammachakra Pravartana Day, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. They think of this as the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. Of course, when the Buddha turned the wheel of the Dharma, that is too. But for them, this was when the wheel of the Dharma really began to turn. Not just in Maharashtra, in many other places, in Gujarat, people will be celebrating. In UP, Modinagar, people have been celebrating, I know this. All over India, in Kerala too, people have been celebrating. We've got representatives of those parts of India here tonight. They'll have been coming together and they're in a tremendously happy, inspired mood. It's difficult to communicate what that would mean unless you're actually there. So for them, this is the turning point in their history. Why? Well, because their own history was so bleak, so dreadful. The people who converted were from the poorest and most oppressed communities in India. You know that India is structured socially to a system of graded inequality, the caste system. I won't tell you the whole horrible story, and it is a horrible story even today for many, many people. That system separates people according to their birth, in a much more rigorous way than a class system does. Sort of overlaps with class, but it's much, much stronger than that. Got sort of features of race, but it's much stronger than that. It's a system of segregation, of exclusion, of privilege, of a quite extraordinarily complex and effective kind. Every Indian village will be dominated by the system of caste. So, for instance, some people will have to take their shoes off when they walk through certain parts of the village. There'll be other parts of the village they can't even take their shoes off, just to give you a tiny little example. So, the system, of course, has many, many winners, but it has far more losers. And at the bottom of the system, something like 16 to 20% of the population of India were traditionally deemed untouchable. That meant that their contact with them, or their contact with eating utensils, with food, and so forth, ritually polluted them. It's difficult to get inside this. The closest I've been able to get at it is if you knew that somebody had been working in a sewer and then hadn't washed properly and had touched your plate, you wouldn't want to eat off it. So it's that sort of feeling that people get when they know that somebody's from a certain caste, not because they're actually dirty or anything like that, but just because they know they're from a certain community or caste. It's a very powerful feeling. Of course, it's a lot different today. India is a democracy. There is an active, positive, affirmative action program and so forth. But it's still very, very strong in Indian life. Especially this observation of untouchability. It's illegal, but it's still very strong indeed. It means that it's difficult for people to get education because they will not be accepted readily. Again, under India's democratic constitution, there's been quite a big change. But a friend of mine who is from these communities, a very, very brilliant Sanskrit scholar, entered a top university in Delhi, JNU, Jawaharlal Nehru University, probably the Cambridge, not the Oxford, the Cambridge of India. And so he wanted to go into the Sanskrit department, and somebody told him, look, somebody from your, there's the head of department, told him, somebody from your community can't learn Sanskrit. You know, well, nowadays they'd put it in these terms, you're genetically not really up to it. Anyway, he went in and he, top scholar, a very pugnacious chap. I really admire him in that way. He sticks up for himself. He's now got a professorship in a big Hindu university in South India. I pity them. I pity them. So that's the sort of impact that today, even in a liberal, educated setting, that background has. It was far, far worse 100 years ago, even up until 30, 40 years ago. And in many parts of India, it's terrible even today. Many, many people from those communities suffer atrocity, is the term that you see commonly used. It's rape, murder, violence against anybody who puts themselves forward. Very common. Because the administrative machine, the police and so forth, in the hands of upper caste influences, very little of that gets prosecuted. Oh, you know, it's a horrible story. Just take the impression, as it were. I'm not going to give you a whole lecture on all that. It's a very, very difficult for us to fully get a grip on, although we know all kinds of exclusion and prejudice and so forth, that they're all wrapped together in a particularly complex and effective form. Is endured for 3,000 years. And is chameleon-like. It adapts to new economic and political circumstances. It's adapted to democracy, the democratic India is dominated by caste influence. So, yes, 100 years ago this was far stronger. And Dr. Ambedkar, born in 1891, was born into that community. He was from a, what we now call the sort of acceptable term is Dalit, which means oppressed. It came from a Dalit community. His father was in the British Army, until the British Army stopped accepting people from that community under pressure from the upper castes. But he had been in the British Army, and that meant he got an education, he was reasonably well paid, and got an opportunity to do a job. And once he was forced to retire from the army gave him a job as a storekeeper. So Dr. Ambedkar's background was rather unusual for people from his Dalit community. His father was very keen on education and insisted on his children getting an education, which meant they had to go to school, sit outside the classroom, and pick up what they could through the window. Dr. Ambedkar tells the story that one day he went into the classroom, not really understanding that he was different, and put his tiffin, his lunchbox, with the other boys' lunchboxes at the back of the classroom. And there was uproar. And they all got their lunchboxes, threw the food away, and protested that, you know, he'd polluted them by the presence of his lunchbox. So he had to endure that sort of deep humiliation. You can't take water from a well, you have to stand and wait for somebody to give it to you, and so on. But he was an unusually brilliant student and picked up a good education quite early. And a Brahmin teacher, there were many very liberal-minded Brahmins, it has to be said, spotted his unusual talent and helped him on his way, got him into a university. He was the first to gain a bachelor's degree from Bombay University, and helped him to get a scholarship to go to America, to Columbia University, where he gained an MA in economics and a doctorate in economics. He then came to London, studied at the London School of Economics, studied for the bar at Gray's Inn, went back to India, and thought, well, he'd educated himself, so he was going to be different now. He'd got beyond his caste disability. He had a sort of progressivist approach, if you see what I mean. And he entered the service of a progressive Maharaja, the Maharaja of Baroda, which was a princely state, sort of nominally independent of the British, but under the firm control of the resident, and entered his political service. But immediately he came up against casteism. He was a brilliant man with, by then, two doctorates, exceptionally intelligent, a very, very quick-minded, very powerful-minded man. He was sitting in his office, and, well, he needs files. So the custom is in India, or was in India, that a peon, a servant, would bring the files from the file room to the desk of the officer. But the peon was of a higher caste than Dr. Ambedkar. So he'd stand in the doorway of the office and throw the files across the room to land on his desk. He couldn't hand them to him. He couldn't find anywhere to live. Nobody would have him in their residence. So he passed himself off as a coming from a different community. Eventually he was found out, cast out, and he had to just sleep in the park. I've been to the place where he sat. Very, very moving just to be there, the place where he sat. A young man with wonderful education, such high hopes, thought here he was, accepted at last. He could then begin to show the way for his own community, and all just blocked. So he seems to have sort of faced a kind of deep crisis in his life, and just not known what to do. He vowed on that spot that, if this is what he suffered, what must it be like for the countless millions? We're talking today about 300 million people who suffer in varying degrees from these disabilities. In Gujarat, this was. So he made this vow that he would dedicate his life to the uplift of his people. From then on, he engaged in very strong political work. He formed a political party for the oppressed masses. The British were reluctantly and slowly trying to introduce a degree of representative democracy at the local level, because that way they could avoid it at the top level. I'm afraid the British don't come out of it particularly well, but there we are. Dr. Ambedkar said that they were better than no British, but they didn't do enough, with their principles, with the what they experienced in democracy at home. They should have done more to end this terrible disability of casteism. So anyway, he became politically active. He formed the Scheduled Caste Federation. He formed a labour union. He worked with the Communist Party in Bombay, fighting for the rights of mill workers. He started various kinds of social action to try to change the disability that people suffered. Most famous is the Mahad Tank Satyagraha, where he went with thousands of his followers and took water from a public tank, which paid for with public subscription, with government funds, but was closed to Dalits, because if they touched the water, it would pollute it. So he went with thousands of his followers to take the water, and quite a bit of negotiation, he was permitted to do so, and some violence, he was permitted to do so. After he'd gone, the tank was ritually purified, and I really enjoy telling you how you ritually purify a polluted tank, a tank polluted by the touch of human beings. You ritually purify it by putting the five products of a cow. Think about it. I won't go into details. Anyway, that purifies the water. There you are. I think I'd rather drink it. Anyway. So, he conducted various campaigns of this kind, for instance, trying to gain temple entry, because Dalits were not allowed to enter into temples. It still happens. In Orissa, just last year, a case came before the courts where Dalits had been excluded from a temple. And a sort of compromise was formed where some bricks were taken out of the wall of the temple so that they could see the image, the take darshan of the image. He worked in this sort of way and worked quite effectively and did become a major sort of force in Indian political life, and became very much the representative of the millions of Dalits all over India. And they had tremendous faith and confidence in him. His exceptional abilities really stood out, and in the late 30s he was brought into the Viceroy's council as the Labour member. So he was taken into the Raj, the British Raj's cabinet, if you like, and he formed legislation which is today the basis for Indian labour law. Exceptionally brilliant lawyer and very effective politician. He couldn't be ignored. He was very cautious about the independence movement. He said that before there can be political freedom, there has to be social freedom. So that if we just have a change of governing system, we're simply replacing one set of oppressors for another. And for all the British, the fault of the British, they at least had ideas of fairness and justice. And if we're subjected to the oppressive force of high castes, that will be far worse for us. And it has to be said, to some extent, that has been justified by history. So he's very cautious about it. He was a very strong patriot. He loved his country. He felt very strongly for India. He believed that colonialism was quite wrong, but he wanted a bigger social change. He believed that social democracy has to precede political democracy. Otherwise, political democracy is colonized by an oppressive social system. In a way, you can see that in many parts of the world. So, yes, he was very cautious about the independence movement. He had a very problematic relationship with Gandhi. This is a whole other story. You know, amongst people in Britain, you know, I saw David Attenborough's film, and I sort of, well, really thought of Gandhi as a great ideal. When I went to India and began to encounter Dr. Ambedkar's followers, I found this was not the right thing to talk about. They don't see him like that at all. They see Gandhi as somebody who used the power of his fasts to force upon Dr. Ambedkar political solutions that were against his interests. That's a whole other story, which I won't go into. But yes, Dr. Ambedkar, a very cautious relationship with the independence movement, a very cautious relationship with Congress. He shared their ultimate ends, but not their immediate tactics. And he certainly wasn't in favour of the withdrawal of support from the British war effort. He believed that Nazism was the greatest evil that the world faced, and it was far more important to deal with that. And he encouraged Dalits to join the Indian Army and fight in the Second World War. So, just to give you a little bit of a flavour of what an interesting and complex man he was, not to be summed up in the stereotypes of Indian politics. A very, very individual man, very much standing for himself, very much standing on his own. But not to be ignored. It's a lion of a man. Quite a big man, a big face you can see there, very strong, quite handsome features, and a very strong voice, a passionate speaker. I've heard recordings of his speaking in a very strong oratorical style. And if he was speaking in Marathi or Hindi, the local languages, he could really move a crowd. If he was speaking in the law courts or in the parliament later, he could stun the house. As a brilliant, brilliant orator, with a very cogent argument. And yes, very unusual points of view, never quite taking the expected point of view, a deep thinker. So he became, he was a great leader. After independence, Gandhi, to his credit, and Pandit Nehru, the first Prime Minister of independent India, recognised his talents. And they invited him to join the first cabinet of the independent India. Partly, of course, a political calculation. They needed the support of the huge number of Dalits. Partly, a genuine recognition of his Dalits, of his talents. Gandhi was definitely an idealist, not merely an opportunist, and saw that this was a man of exceptional talent. So he became the first law minister of the independent India, and was inducted into the Constitutional Committee, the committee that was to form the constitution of the independent India, the Republic of India, which started meeting in after independence in 1947. And very soon it became obvious that he was head and shoulders in talent and ability and energy above all the other members of the committee. And they've all acknowledged that really it was he who wrote the Constitution of India, which is a deeply ironic fact, because for an untouchable, to use that word in this context, just to make the point, to form the constitution under which Indians live today is, does their heads in. Indian social life until quite recently was dominated by a code called the Laws of Manu. It's under those laws that the whole caste system has been regulated. Indian social life generally has been regulated. You know, so for instance, a Dalit who hears the sacred Vedas, well, we know what we must do with him because it says it in the Laws of Manu. You pour boiling lead in his ear, etc. So the Laws of Manu have been the oppressive code, the constitution of Indian social life until relatively recently. So for a Dalit to be the one who wrote those laws under which modern India functions is an extraordinary fact, one that nobody can ignore. And in 1950, he was able to present constitution to the Constituent Assembly, recommend it to them, and it was accepted to acclamation. And it is an extraordinary document. India is, we know, the biggest democracy in the world. It's an extremely effective, although how it keeps going, I've no idea. But it's a remarkable achievement. It's a genuine democracy. People turn out and they vote. And they vote out what they don't like. They vote in what they want. They're often betrayed by their politicians. But there's been a peaceful transfer of government since 1950. With one short exception, which democracy itself brought down. It was an attempt to bring in a sort of kind of dictatorship. But largely Dr. Ambedkar's own achievement. So by 1950, he was an absolutely towering figure and a Dalit. Exceptionally brilliant man, very, very strong orator. Nobody could stand up against him. People would quail in his presence. He'd written the constitution. He was the law minister. And he set out on a program of reform of the Indian penal code and legal system. His special target was what's known as the Hindu code. Each of the separate confessions in India has its own penal code or own social code governing marriage and so forth and so on. So he wanted to bring about a unified code, which he still haven't got in India. There's a move towards it. And he particularly wanted to reform the Hindu code, and especially with a view to bringing greater rights to women, but equal rights to women, to try to bring Indian social code up to the standards of a modern democracy. Property rights, rights of divorce, etc., etc., what one would consider quite normal provisions in a modern society. And he failed. He was opposed by strong conservative forces in the parliament. He was not backed by Nehru, who of course shared his beliefs. He was very much a modern liberal, but for political reasons, he didn't support Dr. Ambedkar. Dr. Ambedkar absolutely, disgusted. He just felt that. He gave a really strong speech in the assembly where he said, "I'm fed up with this constitution. I'd be the first person to burn it." Very strong language, really, really stirred up. He said, "It's as if we've created a beautiful temple for some god to live in it, and a devil lives here." So he resigned from the government. A man of his word, a man of principle, not a man concerned with personal interest or privilege or anything of that kind. And he left politics, really, effectively. No, he didn't leave politics, but he left government. And he began to take up a theme that had been present in his life from very early on. From very early on, he'd begun to realise that the problem was the social, not just merely the social system, but the system of ideas that underlay that system. I think unusual amongst politicians and statesmen, he realised that It's ideas, what we in Buddhism would call views, that dominate life. It's the way we think about things. Not just think in an articulate sense, but the inarticulate, unquestioned, unconscious assumptions we have about what is and how things should be. It's that that shapes things around us. We're always acting out of these attitudes and assumptions. And he saw this very, very clearly, that they were, that the evils of caste were embedded in the religio-social system which we know of as Hinduism. Actually, Hinduism isn't really a religion in the sense that Christianity or Buddhism or Islam are, really. It's more like ancient Greek religion. It's a sort of massive pagan system with a superficial sort of unity imposed upon it relatively recently under the influence of contact with Islam and Christianity. But it's very deeply embedded, very strong beliefs, magical ritual beliefs about social relations. And Dr. Ambedkar saw that for there to be a change in the social system, there needed to be a change in mentality. And he gave a very, very important talk in 1936, where he said that if you want to change caste, you've got to change the ideas out of which caste comes. So caste is an idea. It's a notion. It's not something that really exists. It's not a wall. It's not a piece of barbed wire. It's attitudes that people carry. This is the same with any prejudices that people carry, whether they're racist, sexist, etc., etc. Ideas about what's proper in sex and all the rest of it. It's all in the mind. It doesn't exist out there. And so Dr. Ambedkar said, that's where you've got to deal with it. If you want to really change the social system, you've got to change the mentality of people. Quite an important, unusual perspective for somebody who was such a political leader, such a statesman. So he said that we've tried to reform Hinduism. Many, many reformers have tried to reform Hinduism over centuries. There's been reform movements. Sikhism was a reform movement initially within Hinduism. You get these great, great saints like Kabir, Ravidas, so many saints, the Arya Samaj, all these movements that attempted to reform the Hindu social system. But they all fail. Because it's the fundamental perspective that carries caste. This is something for us to remember because it bears on us too. We'll come to that in a while. So He'd been concerned for a long time that you don't really change things by changing the superficial structure. You make a big difference. There's no doubt that democracy in India, that the change in the system of law, the administration of law, the introduction of positive affirmation, made a huge difference to the lives of countless millions of people in India. There's no doubt about that. So he said, yes, political change is very important, legal change is very important, but fundamentally what you've got to change is the mentality of people. Then the social system will change. And once the social system has changed, then the political and social, the political and legal framework will be easy to change. So whilst he'd been working within government, whilst he'd been working within politics, he'd been conscious that he could only do so much. And for him, coming up against the opposition to the Hindu Code Bill was, the realisation that he'd gone as far as he could. And that although he'd created such a wonderful constitution for India, though he'd been able to establish just labour laws, though he'd been able to enshrine in the constitution the outlawing of untouchability, affirmative action for people from those excluded communities and so on, he's not really been able to change the minds of people in the very parliament building itself. So He went back to a project that he'd been concerned with for a very long time. In 1936, at a conference in a place called Yeola in Maharashtra, he'd said, "I was born a Hindu. I didn't have any choice about that. Nobody asked me. That wasn't my choice. But it is in my power not to die a Hindu. And I vow that I will not die a Hindu." And so he went in quest of a religion that he felt would bring freedom, justice, meaning to his people. And he had a number of criteria for the religion that he would seek. It had to be, well, first of all, a religion that preached, in his terms, liberty, equality and fraternity, which he said, "I got not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha." It's a whole other talk in its own right. Very, very interesting topic. This interpretation of liberty, equality and fraternity go very, very deep into fundamental human values. It had to be a religion that did not contradict reason. He believed that it should be possible to think about the religion without coming up against contradictions between what we can observe and what we're taught that we must believe. You know, so for instance, beliefs about when creation happened, when we've got the fossil record that suggests that probably wasn't like that. He said that we must find a religion that is compatible with a modern, reasoned, scientific outlook. And it must not be a religion that ennobles poverty. He said voluntary poverty is fine, but a religion that says that people are poor because of their past karma, and it's, you know, their just punishment for what they've done before, no, we mustn't go there. Well, I remember the hymn that I used to sing as a child. "The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, he made them high and lowly and ordered their estate." It's a nice God, isn't he? Why? I don't know. That's never explained to me. Anyway, that's partly why I'm a Buddhist. So, yes, Dr. Ambedkar didn't want a religion which justified poverty, justified oppression. And he wanted a religion also that sort of related to India's cultural roots and that would not create too much conflict within India, if you see what I mean. If he'd gone to Islam, which he was offered crores of rupees, many billions of pounds to do, it would have created a bloodbath in India, there's no doubt. It's horrible to think of. If he'd chosen Christianity, probably even worse. But he chose Buddhism, not merely because it was expedient, but because he had a deep and strong feeling for the Buddha. He seems to have had that from very early in his life. His Brahmin teacher, when he was at high school, gave him a life of the Buddha, which made a deep impression on him. And he was a man of considerable devotion. His father was a Kabir Panthi. He was a member of the Kabir devotional sect. So he had that sort of streak in him. And so his attraction to the Buddha was very strong and personal. But he also felt that Buddhism was the right religion for his people, the right religion for India. So from his, I was going to use an India word, ouster from the parliament, once he lost the momentum, as it were, with his political career, his government career, he concentrated more and more on his work of conversion. And the culmination of his work was this great conversion ceremony on the 14th of October 1956. Time of the Suez Crisis, the Russian invasion of Hungary, just to place it in context, but it passed unnoticed. But perhaps one of the more significant events of modern history. 400,000 very poor, very often illiterate people poured into Nagpur from all over Maharashtra, all over India even. People did come from Nagpur, they did come from UP, there were people from Agra there, I've met some of them. Well, I met the people from Ahmedabad who were there. And they converted to Buddhism because of their deep faith in Dr. Ambedkar. Their faith was justified because look what he'd done for them. Look what he'd sacrificed for them. And he was a man of enormous personal sacrifice. It's a wonderful story that, so many stories, but one story I got told of an old lady in Bombay whose husband was very, very sick. And she'd gone to the hospital, and the hospital had sent her away because no money, and tacitly because Dalit, untouchable, don't want it in the hospital. So she thought, what can I do? The only thing I can do is go and see Balasai. So she just went to his house in central Bombay, knocked on the door. He's a big political figure, little old lady, knocked on the door. Dr. Ambedkar himself answered the door at midnight or something like that, and heard her story, sent for his driver, got in the car himself with his driver, drove to her house, collected the husband, took her to the hospital, stayed with her until her husband was being treated properly, made arrangements to be kept informed of what was happening. That was Dr. Ambedkar. Or our own order member, unfortunately, died last year. Shilendra Bodhi, a lovely, lovely little old man. A little ragged boy, 13, 14 years old, came to the end of his education possibilities. He was educated in the village and then hadn't got money to go into the town. His parents were day labourers, no money. Dr. Ambedkar was saying, educate, educate, educate. So he thought, well, what can I do? I must go and see Babasai. This is what they call him, Babasai. So he walked 50 miles into Bombay, again, knocked on the door. Dr. Ambedkar's son opened the door and immediately sent him upstairs. You know, this is, in India, political leaders, they don't act like this. They have these big courts, durbars, where you have to wait for ages and ages and make the appropriate gesture of interest. Chai pani, tea and water, it's called. Anyway, Dr. Ambedkar's son just sent him straight up. Dr. Ambedkar was sitting in the library, and Shilendra Bodhi explained all this to me himself. He went into the library, and Dr. Ambedkar was a very studious man with loads and loads of books all around him. Deep in a book, and Shilendra Bodhi sort of made a gesture like that, and you could see, you know, man deeply concentrated in his book. Very nervous what to do. Dr. Ambedkar looked up, saw him, you know, come over, and then heard his story. I think he was 11. He managed to falter out what his problem was, so Dr. Ambedkar said, okay. Took a piece of paper, wrote something on it, said, take this to my hostel in Thane and tell the principal that I've sent you. So off he went. He got a good education. He entered the British Army and became a sergeant major, I think, and became one of the leading members of our order and started our work in the suburb of India called Ulasnagar. So that's a little flavour of the personal side of Dr. Ambedkar's life. You hear about the millions, but you don't hear about these individual stories. And in the Indian context, it's really, really rare. You know what I mean. Yes, these illiterate people, under the strong, strong feeling for Dr. Ambedkar, for once a leader who really was what he seemed to be, who made no money, who sacrificed his health, they poured into Nagpur. And I know quite a number of people who did go into Nagpur on that day, and I love hearing their stories. Some of you may know Jnana Shuri, a Dhammacharini, one of our senior Dhammacharinis, and she was a little girl of 12, so she was sitting underneath the platform looking right up at Dr. Ambedkar, and she told me this on the 50th, we were going to the Dikshabhumi on the occasion of the 50th anniversary, and she told me this story in a rickshaw, clattering along through the streets of Nagpur, and her face just lit up And I could see she just became a 12-year-old girl sitting, gazing up at Baba Sahib. And her parents, illiterate, day labourers, suffering casteism, they come into Nagpur because getting out of the villages, Dr. Ambedkar said, get out of the villages, in the villages you're subject to caste, you can be identified, get into the towns, it's easier to find work, it's less easy to discriminate, and you can get education much more easily. So her parents had moved into North Nagpur, still a very, very poor area, Indora Square, even today there you can see the slums there. And so they all went in to Nagpur for the conversion ceremony. They didn't know what they were going to, they just knew that they had to wear white, that Baba Sahib said that they should take a new religion. They didn't know what that meant, but what Baba Sahib said, they would follow. So Dr. Ambedkar took the three refuges and the five precepts. He then administered them to his followers, and he gave them 22 vows. It'd be very good to go into those. But what those vows amounted to was a rejection of the old superstitious religious framework within which caste stood. And a strong commitment to the active ethical practice of the Dhamma. So, yes, they converted. And so many people have told me this story. They just got up after the ceremony. They walked home. Many of them have to walk maybe tens of miles, even hundreds of miles, back home to their villages. They go straight inside. They take down the pictures of the Hindu gods. They take down the images if they could afford them. They take them outside and they throw them in the river. Actually, they sometimes throw them somewhere worse, but we won't go into that. They just got rid of the whole superstitious panoply that had oppressed them for centuries. It's a complex issue for us because we've lost our own pagan past, and perhaps we, you know, rather hanker for that sort of rich animist world. But for many, many people all over the world, it's oppression, it's superstition, it's blindness. And they just got rid of it. And it's difficult to communicate the huge change that becoming Buddhists made to people's lives. What they got from Buddhism was, get rid of superstition. You are an equal human being. You are responsible for your own life. Nobody else is responsible. You are responsible for it yourself. You can make your own future. Live an ethical life and create a good society. Create a society of liberty, equality, fraternity for everybody. So these very, very simple messages Dr. Ambedkar communicated in an extraordinarily powerful and effective way. And people did it. So Jnanachuri's parents completely changed their way of life. They started to send her and her brothers and sisters to school, and making tremendous sacrifices. She got a good education, she got a good job, and so on. Another of our friends you may know, Mani Dhamma, some of you will have met. His father, he gave him that shirt. Mani Dhamma, his father I knew quite well, he died a couple of years ago. He was illiterate, he was a bonded labourer. What that really means, you know what bonded labourer means? It means a slave. It means you've taken goods and services to such an extent that you're perpetually bound to serve certain landlords and so forth. He told me that if the landlord said, I'm going to market today, come, he just had to go, no matter what he was doing. Illiterate, very, very poor, a lion. And so he said to his five sons, you must get education. And his daughter, this is very unusual in India, get an education. And they did. So one of his sons became a collector. Well, you know God? Well, a collector is quite close to God. Yeah? For about a million people, a collector is God. He's the chief administrative officer for a district in India. And it's an old, actually it's a Mughal position, which the British took over. They're very, very powerful. They have judicial powers, administrative powers. So for a Dalit to have this sort of position is quite extraordinary. It's because of the Dr. Ambedkar's influence on Manidhamma's father that his son could get that sort of education. It's not just that they made good for themselves. These people have a strong social conscience, a strong sense of social purpose, and that they shouldn't be just living for themselves. This is not always the case nowadays, unfortunately, but by and large people have that strong sense that we should be doing something for others, we should be doing something to serve society. So, I could tell you so much more, but unfortunately you're not an Indian audience, so I can't go on for another hour. And you know, you're not cheering enough. Every time I say goodbye, you should be going, yeah, Jaylene. Yeah, very dull audience, but never mind. You're very tolerant. So that's what we're celebrating. We're celebrating this huge change that took place 50-tum-ty-tum years ago. My maths isn't very good. 54 years ago. Thank you, Dhamshan. And it's now affected the lives indirectly, probably, of most of those 300 million Dalits. Very indirectly in some cases. Dr. Ambedkar's had a very direct effect, but not so many of them know about the conversion movement. But probably 100 million are more or less affected by it. Some 30 million, 40 million, nobody really knows, because the census takers are always caste Hindus and don't put down the religion properly. Of course. We don't really know how many there are. There could be a great deal more if we could only get the message across to them. Many don't hardly know anything about Dr. Ambedkar apart from Jai Bhim, Jai Bhim, Jai Bhim. And that Dr. Ambedkar wrote the Constitution. They don't know what he did for them. Still a hugely influential figure in Indian life. Even outside the Dalit communities, he's a man both highly respected and also reviled. There's a famous book written by a right-wing Hindu figure, Arun Shurin, quite a big political figure, which is called Worshipping False Gods, which was against Dr. Ambedkar. He was the false god that people were worshipping. We don't like that book. A hugely influential figure, but not merely a political figure, not merely a sectional leader. He had a vision for the whole of India, which was based on the idea that for there to be a free and just society, there must be an ethical underpinning. You do not get real democracy unless there is a social attitude of democracy. He said, what is democracy? Democracy is not a system of voting. It is an attitude of respect of one citizen for another. I think we might do with a little bit of that here today. He said, in the end, democracy is Maitri. It's well-wishing of one citizen for another. It's where people feel themselves to be part of a single community working for common ends. That is what democracy really is. So democracy, he believed, could only ultimately work if there was a common system of ethics, deeply human ethics. Again, he was very strongly against theistic ethics. He said it's not ethics at all. Please forgive me. And ethics is not, he said, about the relationship between the human being and a supreme power. Ethics is about relations between one human being and another. It's about caring for each other, considering each other. Our precepts are an embodiment of that. So he believed that for a society to really exist effectively as a democracy, it requires an underpinning in ethical values. And those ethical values have to stand in some vision of what it is to be a human being. What it is to be a human being in the sense that a human being is capable of growth. He said human society exists for the growth of the individual. Our society should assist the growth of the individual. He didn't put all this in Buddhist terms, if you like. Buddhist terms express this in a particularly cogent way. He put it in humanistic terms. I believe all this is extremely relevant the world over. And to me, what Dr. Ambedkar does is bring Buddhism to bear upon our common collective life. I'm from a certain generation. I'm from the 60s generation. I became a Buddhist because I wanted to change the world. I'd been a hippie, and I realized that you could never get hold of enough acid to put it in the water supply and change everybody's consciousness. Try. So I believe that a change in consciousness had to take place through other means, through conscious change, conscious effort. And that ethical values needed to be injected into society. A broader vision of human meaning and purpose needed to be upheld within society. And, that's why I'm a Buddhist, that's why I'm here. I believe that my personal change has to be within a context of a change within society as a whole. The two cannot really be separated. And I think Dr. Ambedkar puts that in an unusually cogent way by his strong recognition of the importance of ethical and fundamental human values for a just and free society. In India, you've got a democracy, but you do not have a free and just society. The legal system, the political system, the economic system is dominated by caste. And caste is dominated by attitudes that are deep in the mind of India. So the same goes everywhere. It goes here too. We're in a mess today because our values are so shallow. You know, the value is that growth means 2 inches more of telly next year. If you see what I mean. 2 inches that way. Another channel, etc., etc. More in the supermarket. That's our understanding of growth. You know, when we hit the economic crisis, our great leaders got together and they came up with a solution. You and I, brothers and sisters, should go shopping. That was their solution. Seriously, it really was. It still is. So Dr. Ambedkar, I think, saw so clearly that, freedom, justice, decent human life rests upon something quite different, on basic human values that he saw embodied in the Buddha Dhamma in an unusually cogent and powerful form. And that's why it's important to celebrate this day. It wasn't just a huge change in the life of India, it was a change in the life of potentially of the whole world. I believe that conversion there has relevance everywhere. It has relevance for the poor and oppressed everywhere. I myself work with gypsies in Hungary who have started an Ambedkarite movement in Hungary because they see the same issues bearing upon them. But I see the same issues also in our apparently free and just and equal society. But go to some housing estates in not many. You don't have to go very far to find a pretty bleak life around in Britain too. So that's the movement that I want to be involved in. I think that's the movement I am involved in. In India, we're working hard for Dr. Ambedkar's work. Our own Tri Ratna community is strongly aligned with that movement. And I hope that we're doing the same work here. If you're interested in our movement in India, well, there are a number of Indians who come from this background, who are sons and daughters of Dr. Ambedkar. They would not be here if it had not been for Dr. Ambedkar. Barawara? There you are, that's Dr. Ambedkar. And if you want to help, there are many, many ways to help. I know that people from Cambridge do go out to India to work with that movement there. Of course, we always need money, needless to say. We need money especially to train people who can be teachers. And we have a trust, the India Dhamma Trust, that raises funds for our work in India, of especially preparing people, men and women, for ordination, so that they can play a leading part in this movement. But there are many, many ways to help, but we also need to do a lot here. In Cambridge too, we're trying to create a new society in miniature. That's what our Wind Horse Trading, what our Cambridge Buddhist Centre are about. They're about creating a new model for society, which has a different economic basis, a different ethical basis, a different social basis. So, change yourself, change the world too, and on October the 14th, remember that revolution, that Dhamma revolution that Dr. Ambedkar launched, and that you can be a revolutionary within, a Dhamma Krantikar in Hindi and modern Indian languages. Jai Bhim.